Bret Hart Radio is presented by Sharpshooter Funding in association with PodcastArena.com and Gao Media.
Are you a small business looking to get over, but you don't have all the funds you need? Well, there's a solution. Check out SharpshooterFunding.com. At Sharpshooter Funding, they know that they have a solution to fit your specific needs. Their team has the experience and knowledge to find you the best product for your specific situation. Whether you're a first-time customer or a repeat business partner, their team will fulfill your needs. Give them a ring at 416-238-0252. That's 416-238-0252. Or send an email to Dallas@sharpshooterfunding.com. Sharpshooter,
easy to execute funding today. It's time to go down to the dungeon and visit the Hart Family Vault. The Hart Family Vault. This is Bret Hart Radio.
All right, this is the Hitman, and it's time to have another edition of the Hart Family Vault.
Yes, welcome back, everybody. It's me, Nick Hausman, joined as always by WWE Hall of Famer Bret the Hitman Hart and his son, Blade Hart. And today in the Hart Family Vault, we are going to be taking a look back at Bret's classic match from 1994 Raw, where he took on the 1-2-3 Kid. Awesome. We're going to have part two of his interview with Josh Barnett. Of course, in that, he gives us 4 out of 10 for this week. And at the end of the show, we're going to go into the mailbag and ask Bret and Blade a question here from the hashtag AskTheHitman mailbag over on Twitter. But before we do, Blade, let's talk a little bit about the sponsor here. Sharpshooter Funding, of course, is the sponsor here for the Hart Family Vault. What's going on right now in the world of Sharpshooter Funding, Blade?
We've been doing a lot of work with some transport companies of all things up here in Canada. We just did a deal for HTC Transport out of British Columbia. And for all the fans out there in Quebec with bad taste in their mouth still from the screw job, just let you know the Harts are still out there helping and doing some work for a company called Sawyer Transport. So, you know, we're all over the country doing some big things. So we're happy about it.
Awesome. Yes, Paul Pitcher helping make it move over there. And, of course, Paul wanted us to reminded us something we've been meaning to bring up here at the top of the show, and I don't know why we haven't yet because I'm very intrigued by this, is the Hart Foundation for the Hall of Fame.com. So, Bret, tell us why this website, Hart Foundation for the Hall of Fame.com, is so important.
Well, I think it's important that that some of the founding members of the Hart Foundation, be it Jim the Anvil Neidhart and even my brother Owen and Davey and Pillman, all, you know, when I look at some of the guys that were inducted this past year, I go, there's no reason why the Hart Foundation shouldn't be in there, and Jim Neidhart should have his moment, as should a lot of other wrestlers from the same era, be it Demolition or Rick Martel or Rick Rude, or, you know, there's quite a long list of, I think, names that have not been properly represented in the Hall of Fame. And I'd like to, you know, take the initiative now to try to get as many people to sign on for this and speak up, and maybe WWE will take notice, and maybe we can change things and see that the Hart Foundation, especially I think me and the Anvil, I know it would mean a lot to the Anvil, and I'd like to be there with him and share that moment of We were a great tag team, and we put in some great years and had some great moments. And I know a lot of fans followed us through those early days, and it'd be great to have our moment, our standing in the sun. You know, we have that right.
Yeah. Right off in the sunset, as they say.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I know that you know, because a lot of issues over the years, you know, it's been difficult to, you know, or maybe for whatever reason, you know, Owen has not been in the Hall of Fame. It would be nice if the Hart Foundation went in. This could be at least a tip of the hat to him inside of the Hall of Fame as well.
Yeah, I think Owen, you know, really, what is the Hall of Fame without Owen in it? He has every right to be in it, and his fans have every right to celebrate his career. His great, he had a great career, and why not remember it and pay special homage to it? And Bulldog, you know, how could you not have a Bulldog in the Hall of Fame? He was, did great stuff with the Dynamite Kid as the Bulldogs. And, you know, he was a great star. And, you know, he was you know, he's in wrestling for a long time, and he was on the road in WWF a long time, paid his dues in the WWF or WWE, and he's a talent worth remembering. You know, if you can remember, like, again, some of the guys that were inducted this past year, I mean, geez, how can you not induct the Demolition? How can you not induct the British Bulldog or the Bulldogs or the Hart Foundation or Rick Rude? Like, come on, you have a responsibility to do justice to history. It's not about personal, you know, if that matter, China should be in the Hall of Fame. You know, it's like, it's a Hall of Fame for wrestlers that contributed through in their careers. And I think you got to open the door to all the people that really belong there. And politics aside, whether Martha Owens' widow doesn't like the old wrestling and she's, you know, doesn't like wrestling fans or the wrestling business, has no good things that she can say about it or be part of, it's she's wrong. You know, there's a lot of people that deserve to remember my brother Owen and the Hart Foundation and you know, all these wrestlers that are no longer here, like Rick Rude, and you know, you can go on. There's just so many people that really deserve to be in the Hall of Fame.
It even kind of goes back to Jake, like listening to Jake about how happy and ecstatic he was to be inducted. It's a big deal.
How can you have a Hall of Fame without the Dynamite Kid in there? Even if you do it where you do it by, you know, where they film him over in England and they play a video or something. I don't know. There's got to be a way to do it. But he deserves that moment for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Well, of course, you can go over to Hart Foundation, Hart Foundation for the Hall of Fame.com. Go check it out. Go sign the petition. Let your voice be heard. And of course, you can let your voices be heard by subscribing to Bret Hart Radio on iTunes absolutely for free. 5-star ratings are always very important, as are your comments to help us move up the iTunes charts. If you guys are enjoying the show, we would appreciate that a lot. And of course, you can find us over at podcastarena.com. But without further ado, let's dust off the keys. Let's open up the vault and dive in, because this week we're talking about Bret's 1994 Monday Night Raw match against the 1-2-3 Kid.
Subscribe to Bret Hart Radio on iTunes. Now back to the show. Here's Bret Hart.
All right, everybody, here we are in the Hart Family Vault. I'm with Blade. I'm with Bret, and we are flashing back to July 11th, 1994, as you put the WWE World Heavyweight Championship on the line against the 1-2-3 Kid. Bret, why did you want to chat about this particular match this week?
Well, you know, it's just an execution match. It's one of those kind of matches where I believe it's one of those matches that has great psychology. And it's a case of what I tried to do throughout my career, but it was one of the best examples of sort of thinking about what would be the best storyline for this guy to wrestle against me. That guy, I knew I was going to wrestle him. Like, I had a week to think about it, and they told me that I was wrestling the Kid on Raw, and they just wanted to do it for whatever reasons. They picked him to have a match for me where he gets a title shot. And, you know, I remember thinking, you know, if it had been me back in my early days, if they'd called me to, you know, where I was going to wrestle Harley Race or something, for example, I know that Harley would have done everything he could to give me the best match possible. And I tried to do the same thing for Kid that night. It was kind of a throwaway match in the sense that it's like, even before they announced it, before the commercial kind of thing, like, coming up next, Bret Hart versus 1-2-3 Kid. You know, no one's really thinking about it, or it doesn't really make, you know, no one's going to miss it if they don't see it kind of thing. But once the match starts, you can start to tell this great story of an underdog, a young guy. He's got this chance of a lifetime to win the title on Monday Night Raw. He's a long shot. The title A never changes hands. But you know what? We're just going to give everyone that belief that maybe, just maybe, tonight someone's going to pull an upset. And it's a great little David and Goliath kind of story of the old veteran, wily old pro against the young pup, you know. And it's a beautiful story. I mean, the story of two wrestlers telling the story the way we did, and him selling the way he did. And I can remember giving him some great elbow smashes, and he would sell them so good, and it looked like they caved his chest in every time I hit him. And, you know, he did a great job of selling and getting a good ass whipping. And then he did a great come back and potatoed me about 10 times with back kicks and drop kicks. And he drop kicked me in the corner. It was like, it was one of the stiffest drop kicks I ever got in my life. But I also know that he was nervous. He was trying his hardest. He was on the cusp of maybe the greatest match of his career. And he totally got into the match and totally got into the storyline and followed every little lead. All the psychology just poured out. And it's a great match. It's one of those matches that if you're a young wrestler in a wrestling school or you're someone thinking of being a wrestler, that would be up there with a match to watch. That's how you want to have psychology. That's how you build a match. You can take your opponent and make him more than anyone anticipated. Sometimes you got to, you know, change up your style a little bit and incorporate different things to make a match with Kid. There was some great, brilliant maneuvers done in the match, and the finish itself was very powerful, very dramatic. He came off the turnbuckle with a drop kick, and I caught his legs and put him in the sharpshooter, and he tapped out. It was very humbling. You know, he tapped out like a little kid that was sort of cried at the end of it, and I kind of helped him up and gave him a big hug and kind of congratulated him on a great match. And anyone watching that, it's all just great drama. And that's why it's a match worth going back and watching or remembering.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is, you know, getting made in a loss, right? Because he looked so much better coming out of this match. I mean, you had Jim Ross and Macho Man Randy Savage on the outside of this ring standing applause saying, this is one of the greatest matches I've ever got to call. And, I mean, yeah, exactly like you said, going from that moment where it kind of seemed like a throwaway going into it and to win everyone over to that level, that's awesome. That's just it's a great story.
I remember getting off the plane the very next day, flying out of like wherever they filmed that. And then we were flying out and we connected through and I met Paul Orndorff and a bunch of the WCW guys, and they could not stop talking about that match with the Kid. Paul Orndorff was like almost in tears talking about it, telling me it was the greatest match he's ever seen. And that's what the business is all about. Not enough people are wrestling like that anymore. And, you know, I just know at the time it was, everybody that did watch it was like, thought that we blew him away and that it was a excellent, real kind of wrestling match that you don't see enough. And again, kind of goes back to what we talked about with Josh, you know, about bringing real to wrestling and at the same time not killing anybody while you do it.
Yeah. And what do you remember, by the way, about Randy Savage from this time period? Because Vince had chosen to put him on commentary, which he was for this match, but later would, of course, go on to an entirely different run over in WCW. I mean, yeah, what are your memories of him in this time period?
You know, I always loved Randy. I liked his commentary. I thought he brought a good sense of logic to the wrestling. And his commentary was always good, always solid. I don't know if he was the greatest, but he certainly wasn't bad. And I always found him entertaining and fun to listen to. I regret, you know, because I don't know, I didn't know the circumstances at the time. Maybe I never will, but I don't know why he wasn't really wrestling much. You know, when I look at my career around that same time period, say 94, 95, they stick me with Kevin Nash. They stick me with this guy. They stick me with that guy. Why they didn't stick me with Randy Macho Man Savage and let us do a huge storyline or a great swap the titles back and forth or build into some kind of a storyline is, I'm sorry that it never happened. It was something that should have happened. We always wanted it to happen. We pleaded with Vince to let us work together. Oh, even through that period that you're talking about. And I know when we finished that match on Raw with me and the 1-2-3 Kid, that Randy Savage was one of the first guys to come back and just be shaking my hand and tell me it was an awesome match. And he loved it. He loved a good wrestling match, Randy Savage. And he was really excited about it. And, you know, I could say that I knew after the match was over that we'd had greatness and it was a great match. And, you know, people throw around classic too often, but that was a classic match that you can dig around in your archives and try to find a match that compares to that and tells that kind of story with the same kind of drama that me and Sean Waltman did. It's not easy to find. It's not easy to replicate. It's not easy to do. And it's a magic. It's magic. And, you know, it's a gift.
Yeah. All right. And with that, guys, we are now going to throw to the second part of our interview, rolling over from the Sharpshooter podcast, which was released on Tuesday. This is with a former UFC heavyweight champion, Josh Barnett. And during this interview, you'll hear the Easter egg 4 out of 10 for this week. But stick around right afterwards for one final hashtag Ask the Hitman question to wrap up our week here on Bret Hart Radio.
Now back to Bret Hart Radio. Here is the WWE Hall of Famer, five-time Slammy Award winner, two-time King of the Ring, and now the podcast champion of the world, Bret the Hitman Hart.
Whenever I wrestled anybody, especially a wrestler that I kind of respected, even if he was just a TV squash match, I always asked him what his best moves were, and let's try to get something into, you know, that you do really well. And, you know, you bring out the best of your opponent that way. And, you know, with two good workers, when you get two really good workers in the ring that want to make it look real and have a lot of fun doing it, it's the best kind of wrestling. I think, you know, it's just like when I think of the match I had, say, with the British Bulldog at Wembley Stadium, we had the 82,000 people, and we basically went out there and tried to put on a pro wrestling kind of babyface clinic with a little bit of a rough edge to it, and it was a great clinic. And people would have thought two baby faces on last would never, you know, keep a crowd satisfied, but we did more than that. And I think we in a lot of ways made history because it was just the right chemistry between the fans and the wrestlers and the type of wrestling that we were delivering.
Well, and they wanted to see you guys wrestle, because while you were a tag team and, you know, you're both baby faces, but the reality is you guys were both top wrestlers. You both were very quality individuals in the ring. They wanted to see high level guys go at it. They want to see what happens regardless of friendships or faces or heels. They just want to see these two studs get in the ring and go for it. See how it turns out.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think what the thing you want the most in a pro wrestling match, the thing you can crave the most, and if it ever delivers itself to you, is that when you can have a work where you have a match that's built up, where when you walk out to the ring and when your opponent walks out to the ring, nobody knows who's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beauty of what happened at Wembley, is that people go, Bulldog's not going to lose in England. And at the same time, they're going, well, Bret Hart's not going to lose to the Bulldog in England. And then the fans get into the match because they know, they don't know who's going to win. And you give them enough false finishes either way, they're gonna have the time of their life because they think every finish is the ending. And it was a great recipe and a great opportunity to deliver that kind of wrestling match. I think a match like that should always be cheered. I mean, probably today, I don't know if they chant "This is awesome" or not, or whether they chant "This is boring."
You know, I think people get too caught up in what the crowd does. You know what I mean? I don't know about you, but I was taught never to wrestle to get the crowd to pop. Just
yeah,
go out there and wrestle.
It was one of the first rules. You never never let the crowd tell you what to do.
Yeah,
I very rarely had a crowd, you know, chant boring in my matches. And if they did, I just stuck with what I was doing and always made them buy into the story or buy into the hold. And they usually bought it. I don't know how I would do well, how I would fare in today's wrestling crowd. It's so, you know, it's a very funny kind of crowd sometimes.
Look, you're Bret Hart. You'll be just fine, in my opinion. You know, I would have no worry about that. You know, and I've given the example of guys like Thatcher who will go out there and work a very scientific match, you know, not working any big high spots or nothing, not doing anything to make the crowd pop, and watch him sit there and start off with "This is awesome" and all this stuff, and he just ignore everything. And then they get quiet, but then they start getting more into it and more into it. And more, by the end of it, of course, when the finish comes and everything culminates, of course, they're all on their feet and they're super stoked to be there. But the reality was, it doesn't matter that, you know, some of these guys go out there in the crowd and the crowd want to dictate. They want to be a part of the match. They want to be involved, or, you know, like a video game or something. But that's not, you don't go to a comics act and go tell him what jokes to tell. Yeah. You know, he goes up there and he tells his stuff. Sometimes stuff is just a setup for the next one, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of guys listen to the crowd and let the fans dictate a lot of things to the wrestlers. And I was always taught to never let them ever do that, that you always take control of your match and your destiny in your match. And just you got to work hard to get them. And that's why I sometimes think that guys like Punk and Daniel Bryan got over so good, is because they delivered such great matches that even the worst skeptics or critics, guys that said they weren't big enough or they weren't good enough or they weren't, you know, they hadn't earned it yet or whatever it is, you know, they showed them all, they proved them all wrong by outworking them. And, you know, I don't know, Josh, who your favorites or guys that you think are the leading guys in the business today, but I'm all for, I love Kevin Owens wrestling. I love Sami Zayn's stuff. This Nakamura, I think that there's a girl, the Japanese girl on NXT that was just so good a Asuka. Few weeks ago.
I know who some of these people are, but I don't watch, I don't have cable, so I don't see WWE stuff at all, or TNA or Ring of Honor. About the only stuff I ever watch is, one, I'll watch old matches on YouTube. Like, I love the Suzuki versus Funaki match from the second UWF. That was freaking awesome. Or I'll watch old matches that way. And I the New Japan stuff. And yeah, Nakamura is fantastic. I've trained him some for fighting and just some of the shoot stuff. But the kid's got a great head on his shoulders. And you know, I think about like a Nakamura or Punk or Brian Danielson. Those guys all worked shoot stuff on their own time to become better legitimate wrestlers at the same time. And so when they go out there,
absolutely,
you know, they can sure put they it did. Together. And yeah. I love Nakamura. I think he's fantastic. Shibata and Goto in New Japan are some of my favorite guys to watch right now. I'm really impressed with them. How they're hard hitting, hard nosed style. Their intensity in their matches. I'm also a big fan of Tim Thatcher, and always of Harry. You know, I'm one of Harry's biggest fans, as well as, you know, a guy in the corner trying to coach him to be his best.
Yeah,
you know, people like that, like Natty, and I'm building Shayna Baszler up to become, you know, hopefully a superstar here in the future. But you know, it's got to be done the right way.
While you're here, Josh, I definitely wanted to get your take and I guess hear you and Brett talk a little bit about, of course, Brock Lesnar coming back for UFC 200. Caught everybody by surprise. I don't know if you were caught by surprise. And what do you think his chances are against Mark Hunt?
And he's a really big physical guy. He's a good wrestler. So I think he's got a decent enough chance. But honestly, I put my money on Hunt, because what has he been doing in his off time? I know that when he was just a full-on fighter, he wouldn't spend that time training to improve himself, to get better in a sport that he had a very short time being involved in. And yet, you're going to tell me when he's doing WWE bookings and what have you that he's going to spend his free time becoming a better fighter? No, I don't see it happening. So I think he's coming in somewhat cold, and it's gonna hurt him in the end.
And then the New Zealander, is that where he's from? New Zealand? He looks like he's got some good fight skills, as far as he's got to throw some good punches. He's heavy a good punches. Fighter, a good fighter, good. He's got good leg kicks and all that stuff. Plus, he's got to be close to the same weight as Brock. I mean, he's built like a tank too. I mean, Brock's a tank, but you know, I think, like I was saying earlier in this interview with you, that it's got to be a tough, as you get older, you know, for Punk and say Brock to 1 minute, you know, you're working arm drags and you're taking wrestling, working with somebody that's trying to protect your body and trying to deliver a great match out of you and help you through the pro wrestling experience. And then going from that to a guy trying to take your head off and, you know, a guy trying to break your back or whatever it takes to win the match kind of thing. It's got to be a tough adjustment to go back and forth on. I think, you know, and I never did both or anything like that, but I think it would be really hard for me, especially later on in my career when I had so much formed the mentality and the sort of the physical prowess to be a professional wrestler. It would have been awful hard to shake that and suddenly go into full-on, gladiator UFC fighting. You know, it would have been really tough to make that adjustment. I don't know that I could have, but that's a credit to all the UFC guys that do it.
You raise a great point in that, you know, for yourself in this case, you know, you had trained to be a working professional wrestler the whole time, and you were not spending a bunch of time you know, prepping yourself to fight or shoot necessarily, you know, training shoot holds and shoot, doing a little bit of shoot work here and there, but your intent was to be a worker. And with, you know, with Punk, you know, you worry about the injuries over time. But the other thing is the WWE schedule is so insane that, you know, when you're involved in that, there's no time hardly to take off to train. But, you know, in Brock's case, he doesn't have to do that schedule. His is a completely different setup. He's only got X amount of appearances, only X amount of actual physical matches. So he does have that time, but I still don't think he would have spent it wisely. And at the same time, you know, there's guys like Harry who have stuck with doing all the shoot training and fight training and sparring on his in-between, which helps him to keep, you know, the fighting mindset. And every time he comes out here to L.A., you know, I put him in the ring with people. I put him in the ring with a highly decorated grappling champion and made him go 2 out of 3 falls with the guy. And he beat him, you know, both times. But, you know, he went against a guy that is on the mats all the time and winning championships, winning medals, and submitting people. And I said, all right, well, here you go. This is what you do. This is who you are. I don't care if you go out there and work. This is your base. So Harry sucks it up and goes out there and goes after him.
Yeah, I can think that kind of background would only enhance your pro wrestling. If like hypothetically, if I could have been a CrossFit guy back when I was wrestling years ago, I mean, it would have been great for my career if I'd had the time to do CrossFit every day and do that kind of stuff. But I mean, the thought of actually being in that kind of condition to be a professional wrestler would be, I don't know, make you a pretty good, damn good athlete. I think you could be, you know, wrestling would be easy after all that.
Yeah, I think so. And I would say that, you know, if we rewound that clock with the people that were around you back then, Brett, they could have had you ready to fight, ready to work, you know, if only people were thinking that was an option. You know what I mean? You know, if they were considering that, it's like, you know, Stu and Tokyo Joe and all the, you know, even some of the guys you used to work could easily have been working with you on different stuff to prep you for what you needed to do. But it wasn't really something to consider.
You know, I've been very proud of the fact that my pro wrestling career is like, I always tried my hardest to bring it, deliver a sort, at least a real flavor of wrestling to my pro wrestling. And, you know, I take great pride in knowing that I never injured one wrestler in my whole career. And, you know, we had a few weeks ago, we were talking about Seth Rollins' knee and John Cena in the face. And, you know, it's an important business in the sense that pro wrestling is, it's much more of a, you want to do everything you can to make it look as real as possible, but you want to make it totally safe and totally where no one gets hurt. And someone like a UFC guy fighting in pro wrestling can use it as a way to heal up and go further on his career in UFC if he wants to. Wrestling is very important to be done, you know, as real as possible, but the whole object is that nobody gets hurt. Nobody ever gets hurt. You know, you hope that nobody even breaks a fingernail in pro wrestling, but, you know, wrestling is what it is. People get hurt all the time.
That's true. And with people taking bigger and bigger risks, I've been at indie shows, you know, watching some of my friends or some of my students go out there and work, and watching guys taking all kinds of crazy suplexes and head bumps and flying out of the ring. And it's just like, man, there's only 60 people here. Why are you doing that to yourself?
Yeah. I wanted to throw one more topic out here while we got you right now, Josh, to kind of switch gears completely. There was this story that started floating around yesterday that UFC has since denied and said is false from Flow Combat about UFC being sold for $4.2 billion to these four investment groups. To the best of your knowledge, this story is false, correct, Josh?
I couldn't say one way or the other. You know, I'm not really privy to that kind of information, but, you know, you hear so much of it already being sold. And, you know, why? I could easily see the UFC trying to put up a smokescreen to say that it hasn't. So I don't know what that would really benefit them necessarily, but for all we know, it's been sold. That it's the deal's already been done. The checks have already cashed, and they're just working out all the particulars.
Yeah, and the reason I bring this up is, Brett, it made me think, you know, what are the odds that you think that Vince would ever do a deal like this where he would sell the whole company, the WWE, for billions of dollars, and the McMahons take off and they leave the control of the company with somebody else? Do you think that's ever a possibility?
I suppose it's always a possibility, but I don't think the McMahons will ever sell. It's a money printing machine, you know, so they can make all the money they'll ever need. I think Vince truly loves the business, and I think for whatever it's worth, I think Stephanie and Shane both love the business. They even Triple H, they love it. It's the it's the greatest fun job of a lifetime. You, being Triple H and getting on Learjets and Shane and working out what's going to happen this week and all the drama that comes along with it. There's a lot of hard work, but I'm sure they love every bit of it. And, you know, I don't think that money can buy that. And same with Dana White. I just don't – why would he sell it? I mean, I think he loves it, and they're passionate about it. And if they sell it to someone else, maybe they're not going to have the same passion. I don't know. I think that there's a lot of guys that – I don't think those guys are all still really young. They're not going to sell UFC for a long time, not till they're in their 90s.
Well, I mean, they may sell it. You know, what they're saying is that it's being sold on the Fertitta side of things, but that Dana would stay in some sort of role with them, maybe in his position as president. But, you know, you bring up a point of, you know, there's the money aspect. You know, these guys are all making a lot of money, the McMahons, you know, Trips, and Dana. But there's also a ton of power, right? There's a huge ego stroke in being in that position and moving those chess pieces around. And, you know, leaving that is going to be, it's addicting. I think it's hard,
for sure.
Hard for a person to not be the person with that kind of power at their disposal all the time.
They're what you call the movers and shakers. Like, they don't, you can't buy that kind of excitement and thrill of, you know, basically playing God with everyone's careers. And, you know, you can do whatever you want, and your Learjets and limos everywhere you go. And you got, you know, it must be a fun life being Vince McMahon, but it must be a lot of hard work too.
Well, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, in their eyes, it balances out any of the hard work that they put into, which, you know, you know, after a while, that whenever you get into something, no matter how difficult it is to get it done, once you've got that time already invested into doing it, that sort of consistency with it, you don't even think about it anymore. You just get it done. You know what I mean?
You become so consumed by it. I mean, it's just so, it's your whole life. I mean, I'm sure all those parties I just named, it's WWE all week long. You're thinking about it constantly. You don't have any other kind of, you have no other life. Your life consists of looking at another picture of another wrestler and writing down his stats and watching this guy and figuring out the storylines for the next Raw, and all this power and all this excitement and drama, and you're going to fire this many guys, and they're going to do this, and they're going to sack Roman Reigns. And it's all this power. It's like, when you take all that away from them, what do they got? You just can't take all that power away. And same with Dana White. I'm sure that he's got so much on the go that, you know, it's that is his life. He doesn't want to give up that. He doesn't want to give up his life. He wants to do it forever. It becomes like a drug.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, Vincent parties, they tried to find something else to do with their life. Bodybuilding, that didn't work out. XFL, that you know, that distraction wasn't so good either. So
these are guys that don't even have friends. They have no other life. They never go to a concert. They never go to a hockey game. They have no life. Everything is writing something down for next week or taking a call from this wrestler. And I mean, it's a lot of hard work, and it consumes your life. And some people, it does become a drug, and you can't live without it. And, you know, it's just the joy of it. I'm sure it's the same in politics and same with a lot of things.
Yeah, sure enough, like me and coffee.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're coffee fans here. I know, Blade, you're a big fan of the lobsters that Vince has in the office and things of that nature. So,
the all-you-can-eat sushi never hurts either.
He's been a quad cafe Americano guy.
Blade.
From Tim Hortons?
I can't even do the Timmy's. My dad likes this really dark, slimy, deep coffee, and he's actually kind of got me hooked on it. So,
yeah, but it actually is Tim Hortons coffee. Is my coffee. That's my plug for the day. My 4 out of 10 will go. You'll go to Starbucks.
Wonderful. Well, there you go. That is the 4 out of 10 right there. Blade, I know you've been listening here, taking it all in here. Obviously amazing having Josh and Brett talking at the same time. Is there anything that popped into your head, anything you wanted to ask Josh or your dad here before we wrapped up the interview?
I would just say a lot of respect to Josh for what he does. You know, that's pretty crazy. Even some of the stuff I've watched, you know, Harry do just through his social media and stuff, man, it takes a lot of time, a lot of practice, a lot of skill. It's really impressive stuff, man.
Well, I love professional wrestling. When I don't know what they put down in my tail of the tape and all that when I walked to their cage. But, you know, they asked me, oh, what style do you want? I say, pro wrestling. I am a professional wrestler. I go out there and I fight for the entertainment of the fans, you know. I'm a pro wrestler like Carl was, like Billy, like Inoki, like anybody that has ever invested in me. I'm a professional wrestler. Where it's shooting or working, it's one of the same.
Well, hopefully we'll see a German suplex on the guy you fight there in September.
I'd love to. A big German suplex, maybe a backbreaker.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Good luck in all that. You know, we really, you know, we'll be rooting for you and cheering you on. And I hope the training as you go into that fight is everything you want it to be. And, you know, our prayers are with you on the fight day.
No, thank you very much.
It's time for 4 out of 10. 4 out of 10.
I give it a 4 out of 10.
A nod to those who failed to excellently execute.
4 out of 10
on Bret Hart Radio.
All right, guys. Well, here it is. Each week on Bret Hart Radio, of course, on the Hart Family Vault, we give Bret and Blade a chance to give something, someone, or something a 4 out of 10. Bret's patented catchphrase. So, Bret, what is it this week? Who is getting the 4 out of 10?
Well, you know, I think that the guy that should get the 4 out of 10 this week is the guy that got arrested for trying to assassinate Trump.
Right.
You know, he should get a 4 out of 10 for screwing up and dropping the ball in the first place. And at the same time, you know, he really botched everything up, and
yeah.
You know, now he's in jail. Talking, it's like, you know, like trying to explain that one to your, you know, to your wife or your kids or something, like, yeah, kind of decide to kill Trump this week. And A, I failed, and B, I got arrested, now I'm doing time. And then he made the statement that if he gets out, he's going to try it again. And I think that's not going to help his case much. But I thought he deserves, like, not a 1 out of 10, but like a 4 out of 10. He is the perfect 4 out of 10.
Yeah, yeah. You blew it. Botched the spot. The Trump assassination.
I think he had the right idea, though. I don't know. If it would have happened, I wouldn't have been too upset about him.
He could have been a hero.
To our Canadian friends up north, Bret the Hitman Hart and Blade Hart up there. Yes, I'm living it right now. As somebody who really wanted Bernie to take this thing, it kills me right now to see what's going on in politics here in the States. But anyway, let's move away from politics here real quickly. Right now, we are going to jump over into the mailbag. If you are interested in asking Bret and Blade a question here on the show, you can go over to Twitter. Use the hashtag AskTheHitman. To ask Bret or Blade a question here. And Bret, this week we're going to go over to our good buddies. I'll do two questions here because the first one, I don't know if you guys have a huge opinion on it or not. But AKA Magnum CA, @_MagnumCA, he asked, Bret, what are your thoughts on the now infamous Ricochet versus Will Ospreay match? Now, I don't know if you guys have had a chance to watch this match yet, but it's the one that was getting a lot of people talking about over athleticism, a lot of flips and matches and things like that.
You know, I didn't see it. I really could watch it. So, I mean, maybe it's I like to watch a good wrestling match. So, I mean, it's something I'll check into, but I didn't see it or hear anything about it. So before I make comment about it, I'd rather watch it.
For sure. All right. Well, then I'll throw one out here. I know for sure we're going to get some opinions on Dominic Tango @Dom340. He says, Bret, what are your thoughts on the late Sensational Sherry?
You know, I loved Sensational Sherry. She was always one of the boys. You know, she was one of the guys, and totally one of the wrestlers. Like, she, you know, if you were a wrestler and you need someone to back you up in a fight, Scary Sherry would have been a good person to have on your side. She was a fearless friend and a very good person, and a real good-hearted girl that was a proud worker. She was probably, I think, technically, maybe the greatest lady wrestler of all time. She really was the best. I think she could put her up there with Mildred Burke and June Byers and Mo Mula and whoever you want, Natty or whoever you want. But Sherry was the consummate professional. And I've had a lot of people over my career ask me about punches. You know, I always thought I threw a good punch, and I've had a lot of people tell me that they love how I throw punches, and my punches always looked the most real. And they say, we want to learn how to throw punches like that. And I would tell them, I said, you know, you just got to watch Sensational Sherry throw punches. She throws better punches better than anybody. And she did. She threw great punches. she was a very skilled worker, you know, that was a pro every night and could go in there with whatever caliber girl wrestler that she was working with. Sherry would always get a good match out of her. Never ever hurt anybody, never ever injure anybody, never ever injure herself. She was just the consummate professional all the time, and just one of the real pioneers of lady wrestling today. I mean, there wouldn't be, the business would not be the same without her.
Bret Hart Radio is a TJ DeSantis production. In association with Nick Houseman and Sharpshooter Funding, Bret Hart Radio. Its content is intended for private use only.